You are listening to a sermon by Michael Thomas, recorded on Sunday, November 6, 2011, at the Point Grey Interminnonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
First off, I just want to say it has been a pleasure attending a church where people actually know how to sing four-part harmony, and I agree, that was one of the more fun renditions of that song that I've done since I was in high school. So you guys are excellent sight readers, and yeah. Today, looking at our passages of scripture that we have encountered in the lectionary today, I think that first impression, we're inclined to get the question that a lot of modern people have when encountering these kinds of texts. I think it's appropriate that in the original lectionary that I read, the passage from Joshua was only Joshua 24, 1 through 3a, and then 14 and 15. However, again, I think it's very appropriate because a lot of times modern readers have a very hard time coming back to these particular texts and wondering why on earth we should care. At Regent now, in my Old Testament seminar, we are having to read through the entire Old Testament, and even the stoutest-hearted theologian will usually get somewhat faint-hearted after about 8 chapters of genealogies in 1 Chronicles. So when we approach these texts, we have to ask ourselves, not to give him too much credit, but we have to ask ourselves, along with Christopher Hitchens, would the world perhaps be a better place if we had not spent so much time worried about the political squabblings of the ancient Near East? The answer that I think we come to is no. That we need to know this story in all of its detail, in all of its goriness, in all of its oftentimes confusing aspect, in order for us to know who we are and where we fit in this story. And so with that in mind, I just wanted to approach these texts and look at them on the basis of what they have to say to us as far as where we came from, what that means about where we're going, and how both of those things affect how we live here and now. I think this theme of historical awareness and contextual awareness is one that's especially important in today's context because we live in a society that is increasingly, well, illiterate. Not only literally, but also mentally. We don't know where we came from, and therefore we don't know where we're going, and therefore we don't know who we are. I think it's interesting to note, like, if just reading through the Proverbs, one can't help but notice the degree of respect that is placed on age. And young people are urged to go to those who have more life and wisdom and experience and benefit from that life, wisdom, and experience. By contrast, the generation of youth that's being raised today has, well, Before I try and make an allusion, have any of you guys watched The Simpsons? Okay, well, there's at least two. This is for you too. I think that the generation of today largely has the impression of the elders, not as the greatest generation, but as Grandpa Simpson. A problem to be sent away, dealt with as little as possible, and whose stories at all costs are to be avoided. But as a result of this, we find that we don't know who we are, and we don't know where we came from. Alistair MacIntyre, who's one of the foremost philosophers of the 20th century, said that I can know what I am to do if I know the story of which I am a part. If you deny children stories, you leave them nervous stutterers in thought, word, and action. I think it was Tolkien. This was a quote that was given to me actually at Regent Orientation, so I unfortunately was writing too fast to write down whose name it was. He said that people perish because they cannot tell the end from the beginning. The conclusion is that people, all people, are wired for story, not simply to tell them, not simply as an act of imagination, but as an act of identity, in order for us to know who we are. In order for us to know what we are to do, we have to know what is the story in which we participate. And so it's with this in mind that I'd like to look at the passages that we've examined today. The Joshua passage in particular kind of highlights this theme of being dependent on the previous generation to inform us of and remind us of what has happened and what the ramifications are for that and for us today. We wonder, perhaps in a sense, why it is that Joshua feels it so necessary to take a very long time, evidently, to rehash in almost painful detail everything that had happened with this generation. Especially because most of the events that Joshua is describing could probably have been remembered by the people who were hearing them. But time and again, throughout the entire Old Testament and the New, we see this reminder, this admonition to speak of these things always and bind them around your heads. Put them on the signposts of your door. Talk about them with your children when you are sleeping, when you are rising. The point is, you may think you remember, but unless you explicitly go back, you think about what has happened, you will in some sense lose the direction from which you came, and you will therefore be unable to fulfill the obligations that you have, to fulfill the identity that you have on the basis of this past. Now it's interesting to note too that Joshua lives in a very communal society, that he is addressing the children of the previous generation, but he views their parents' story as their story. There is not, in a sense, a fresh start with each generation. Each generation in some way inherits both the legacy, or inherits the legacy, both positive and negative, of its forebears. And so Joshua sees the need to start not with this generation when it was born in the wilderness, but with their parents' story, because that is the story which they have inherited. This is why it is so important for the generations to be able to connect with each other, because without that, we remain a shell of who we were meant to be. Only partially knowing who we are, and only partially understanding where we come from. Now, Joshua doesn't simply stop, of course, with the story of your ancestors, Terah and his sons Abraham and Nahor, all the way through the Exodus of Egypt. He continues by showing them how their particular story fits into this larger whole. I think it's interesting, kind of on that note, I was reading a book by Ravi Zacharias, who is an Indian theologian, East Indian, and he told of one occasion where he was to be introduced at a conference, and it was a pretty prestigious conference, and so and this was in India, so they went up to introduce him, and they began by talking about his father. Matter of fact, they spent about 5 minutes talking about his father. The conclusion and the concluding sentence, the only actual reference to Ravi in the entire speech was, "And this is his son who is here with us today." The notion that your identity is so powerfully tied up in where you came from is, I think, something that we often lose in our modern generation, where we view ourselves as autonomous individuals. To the degree that we're autonomous and we lose track of this story, I think we in some sense cease to be fully human. But Joshua isn't just in the mood for storytelling. It's important that this story has a point. "Now therefore, revere the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that your ancestors served beyond the river in the Nile and served the Lord." We are called not simply to engage in a story as an act of imagination or exercise. We are called to live in the story. And that is both a terrific opportunity and a terrific responsibility to realize that we have within us the power to continue this legacy that we have received, but also that we have the power to fail the legacy that we've received. It puts a tremendous weight on daily actions that I don't think most of us are accustomed to really thinking of. To realize that everything we do is not simply an isolated event occurring in a random series of events, but is in fact a crucial plot point in a story that is much larger than us. Now, while we receive this story from our forebears, then again, at some point there comes a point when the vision has to be ours. Our mothers and fathers can tell us what they have seen. They can try and help us to see what they have seen. But if we do not make the effort to own that vision ourselves, then the vision dies. It was another historian whose name I was not able to find, said that Christianity is always one generation away from extinction, but it is also always one generation away from renewal. Whether or not, basically, we can picture, I think, this whole legacy as a very long relay, and the baton keeps on getting passed. And each generation has the opportunity to decide what it is they want to do with that baton, whether they will run with all of their heart, or whether they will decide that they are simply tired of the race. Now, if we're to truly view this as a story, we have to realize that the story isn't over. And if the story isn't over, then it has not simply a beginning, but also an ending. And we come to the passage in 1 Thessalonians 4:13 through 18, where Paul is talking about us, or is talking about Christian life in the light of this ending. Now, talking about Christian hope is another somewhat difficult thing to do in the context of today, because hope is another one of those poor words that has been badly impoverished in modern usage. When we say hope, we mean something like not even strong enough to be a wish. I hope it doesn't rain. Well, I would kind of like it not to rain, but I'm not placing my bets on it. A hope is only a, he hasn't got a prayer, he hasn't got a hope. That's the two, like, you know someone's really rock bottom if they don't even have a hope. So how on earth are we supposed to make, basically make something powerful out of this notion of Christian hope, if hope is such a weak concept? I think that St. Paul in this case gives us an opportunity to see what hope really is, and to reclaim a word that has been unjustly impoverished. The question here is not, can we keep a game face on even when we're feeling sad? Or can we vaguely wish that things were better than they are now without actually really expecting them to be? The call of hope, as laid out in 1 Thessalonians, is a powerful call to action for each of us when we encounter those points where expectations are disappointed. When we're taking that baton and running that race and we are tired and we are thirsty and we've got shin splints and we just want to stop. And in this particular occasion, that is exactly the circumstances that Paul is writing to. The Thessalonians received the gospel with joy. Things went downhill from there. They were persecuted by the city, which happened to be a powerful... They were persecuted by the city, which happened to be a powerful economic center. They were put up against the forces of the state. Paul himself was forced to flee, and they felt abandoned. To top it all off, some of their congregation started to die. They were under the impression that the return of Christ was imminent. How are they supposed to have hope when some of their congregation is not going to be around to see Christ return? It is in this context that Paul writes them to tell them what it is that hope is. And what he does is not assert happy platitudes or nice Hallmark slogans. What he does, interestingly enough, is a recall of past events, past facts. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have died. We have the unfortunate tendency to be very forgetful. And it is when we are forgetful, I think, that we cease to be hopeful. At least speaking for myself. It's easy to attribute, I think, reason a greater power than it has in order to keep our compass straight. If reason is not grounded in conviction, then it will simply justify whatever it is that we happen to see at the moment or not see. There's been a good many times in my life where I hit up against a point and I just do not know what's going on. And my reason is always trying to look for some way to explain present events and fit them into some larger narrative, and as a result, that narrative is always changing. The interesting thing that Paul is doing here is not saying, you know, not contrasting hope to reason, but he's giving reason a foundation. He's saying, no matter what you see at this present moment, realize that that is not all that there is. We live in the light, not of this abstract feeling, but we live in the life of this past event. And because of this event, no matter what we see or do not see at this moment, we have the strength to keep going because we know that it is true. Or as one of my friends put it in college, do not doubt in the darkness what you have seen in the day. The fact that you can't see it now doesn't mean that it's necessarily changed. And it's also important to remember, in looking at this Thessalonians passage, the final words. Paul goes through and explicitly talks about what it is that believers can hope for on the basis of this past event. And what's the conclusion of this? Therefore, encourage each other with these words. For any one person to assume that they can keep this broad perspective in mind constantly or even consistently is, I think, very optimistic. I have yet to meet a person who has that much will and self-control. Therefore, it is necessary to meet up with other people who may, at this particular juncture and moment, can see the things that we once saw but don't see at this present moment. To be encouraged and lifted up by the vision of other people when we ourselves are blind. Therefore, encourage each other with these words. Remember that if you have hope, it is for the benefit of others who have none. If you do not have hope, it is for the benefit of those who do, that they may have the opportunity to share, and that they may have the opportunity to come together and to see together. Finally, we get to the gospel passage, the 10 virgins, the 10 bridesmaids. And we're reminded in this passage that it is in this passage, really, that I think past remembrance and present hope are brought together. We are reminded that we are not simply to keep these things as abstractions or as tools for making sense of the world around us. We are to respond to what we have seen. Now, it's interesting to note in this passage the context that this happens. The kingdom of heaven will be like this. This is in the context of Matthew's little apocalypse. And The crucial thing to note about this little apocalypse is that it is not an easy time to have hope. As a matter of fact, it's a time when the most logical or sensible thing to do based solely on circumstances would be to give up hope. He talks about wars and rumors of wars, persecutions, oppressions. In light of this present Sunday, we might add global warming, environmental catastrophe. We might add a number of other things that are happening. In these contexts, does it make sense to still have hope? Well, yes. Because what we see is not all that there is. The interesting thing about Christian hope, I guess, is that it has the unfortunate tendency of being written off as pie in the sky when you die. Mm-hmm. And when you approach Scripture itself, there is no way that you can really get that impression. It is a much, much harder, but much, much richer concept than that. And it calls not simply for us to be optimistic about some vague future state. It calls us to be prepared in this moment. Now, I have difficulty with passages like this. I was often told by a good many people that the whole Bible was very hard for them, but the Gospels, that's what made sense. That's how it held together, was in the person and the words of Jesus. And for a very long time, I had a hard time with that, because Jesus was precisely the person that I had the hardest time with. In the whole Bible, I can appreciate the beauty of the Psalms, I can appreciate the truth and the prophets, but Jesus comes and he's saying all of these very intolerant things about locking bridesmaids out because they didn't have their lamps trimmed and burning. And if I read this story, I honestly see myself more in line with the five foolish bridesmaids. Why is it that they didn't bring extra oil? My guess is they were probably like me, and they were very cheap. And they did a cost-benefit analysis, and they said, well, we figure the bridegroom is probably coming about an hour or two after dark. We got plenty of oil for there. Extra oil costs more than we really want to do. And if worse comes to worse, we can always mooch. That is the solution for all problems. And so for that reason, I intuitively have a hard time accepting this. But what I have to come to grips with is I think that the moral of this story is that and Pascal's wager was wrong. Pascal famously said, you might as well believe in God because, well, if you do, then you might win everything. If you don't, you might lose everything. If God doesn't exist, then it doesn't really matter. I think what Jesus is telling here is it does matter. You only have one life to gamble. And what you do with that life depends on what story you're a part of. And it has powerful relevance for how you act in not just the story you receive and the story you hope for, but in the present today. So, keep your lamps trimmed and burning.